After painful exits from the FA Cup and Europa League, the Premier League title is the only show in town for Liverpool. They probably have to win all of their remaining games to have a shot at lifting the big one in mid-May. The next step on their perilous journey is a short one, as it takes them just across Stanley Park to face their old foes Everton, who have their own agenda, needing points to secure survival. I'm Kevin Hatchard, and this is Football Only Better. A big midweek card in the Premier League, so we've brought Mark O'Hare back into the starting side after illness. He's raring to go. Mark, Liverpool played pretty well against Fulham, I thought, on Sunday, but this Merseyside derby, a different type of test.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the title race is obviously very delicately poised, but there was a lot of negativity around it, wasn't it? About 8 days ago when Arsenal and Liverpool both lost on Super Sunday, we thought the title race might be done and dusted. But this gives both Liverpool and Arsenal a great opportunity this midweek to put pressure on Man City, because obviously they're ahead of City now after City's involvement in the FA Cup, and then we have opportunity this midweek to stamp down that authority as well before City play again on Thursday. But it's obviously going to be easier said than done, because both Liverpool and Arsenal have tough matches against opponents. So I think we'd like to scupper those chances as well, which gives us an extra layer of spice, I think, to these games. Yeah, I thought Liverpool played pretty well at Fulham despite all those changes, and I think it was quite good to see Liverpool or Klopp actually bring the cavalry off the bench in that second half to finish the job at Craven Cottage, a venue where Liverpool have had some struggles in recent years. But yeah, they've obviously had some struggles at Goodison Park as well, even if they haven't necessarily lost often. Everton haven't actually beaten Liverpool with supporters present since 2010, so 14 years. But I think they have tended to make life a little bit more difficult at Goodison. Since that victory in 2010, these two teams have played out 8 draws in 11 meetings in the Premier League at Goodison. 3 Liverpool wins, 0 Everton triumphs, of course, but 5 goalless draws. So the draw here is actually quite tempting, I thought, at 5-10 on the exchange. The 0-0, a repeat, is 22.0. I probably wouldn't be backing that, in all honesty, but big prices
yeah,
there if you are interested.
Yeah, watch for the 90 minutes, isn't it, back yeah. In the 0-0.
Yeah, you might as well not watch it at all or sit behind the sofa because, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if Lewis is on the 0-0 at all at 22.0. The man eats value. But yeah, I'd have been more on the side of Everton with a goal and a quarter start here on the Asian handicap at 187, just because you get a lot more on side. Obviously the price is significantly short of any of those, but you get the Everton win, unlikely of course, but the draw or a defeat by exactly one goal for Liverpool would make you money. Only a Liverpool win by 2 or more sees that stake lost. But yeah, I do think they can make life difficult for Liverpool. The 6-0 at Chelsea I didn't think was reflective of Everton this season, even if they have regressed quite a way since perhaps the late autumn. It was an abomination, that performance. And the weekend win against Forest wasn't exactly pretty at all. But I think at this stage of the season, it's a case of just getting the job done any way that's possible. And they're now in quite a positive position in that relegation battle, almost able to kind of go into defensive preservation mode in this particular match, because a point here would give them a much more positive return ahead of Luton or even Burnley with a goal difference as well to match too. So, you know, it probably was a long time ago now, but I just remember back to kind of both games away from Goodison Park when Everton have gone to sort of the two sides in terms of Liverpool and Man City and set up quite impressively, I thought, to try and nullify the opposition. And I think they've done a very good job of doing so at Anfield and the Etihad. You know, a red card was against them at Anfield, but they held out for 75 minutes until there was a penalty as well. City took 70 minutes to break them down at the Etihad as well. And actually, if you look at the City-Everton game at Goodison Park too, Everton started that match pretty strongly. I know City were back off the Club World Cup, but they led at half-time before City came on strong in that second half to win that fixture. So I'm actually going to propose a half-time draw here instead at 2.62, because that's been a winner in half of Everton's 16 home games this season. So that immediately caught my attention, but more so actually was the goals against column in the first half at Goodison this season. Just 5 goals conceded before half-time in 16 home games, which is the equal best in the division in terms of first half home defensive records alongside Man City. So Everton are pretty good at kind of resisting sides, at least with the first 45 minutes at home. Arsenal, City, Chelsea, Villa have all come here and failed to score before the interval. And if you like the 0-0 first half correct score, is 3.6. So a decent leap on that half-time draw price of 2.62. As for Liverpool, they've only been ahead actually at half-time on five occasions away from Anfield. Half of their fixtures away from Anfield have been half-time draws. They've only actually scored 10 first-half goals themselves in 16 away days. They've already had a half-time draw at Fulham at the weekend, at Forest a fortnight ago. So that's two of the last three away. Chuck in Bournemouth and a trip to Palace as well since the start of February. The games which they haven't been held at half-time, 1-0 at Burnley, 1-0 at Brentford, and 1-0 at Man United. Those are half-time scores, of course. So they're the three outliers in that sample. So a mix of pretty middling to average teams at best in the Premier League, and they've not exactly been cutting loose in the first half of the game. So it felt like it was worth a shot in this match because I'm not expecting things to escalate into anything too dramatic in terms of a high-scoring affair, considering Everton's approach. But on the Liverpool side of things, I think you have to have a little mention here of the guy who's been talked about a few times in recent shows, particularly under Lewis's watch, but Diogo Jota to score at any time at 9-5. That looks too big a price, even if the goal expectancy for me is relatively low here. He is Liverpool's top man in the final third for finishing ability, a goal at the weekend. He's now operating at 0.79 goals per 90 this season, scoring every 112 minutes in the Premier League, which is incredibly good numbers. So he's 9-5, which I think is a great price. Should he start, Liverpool's goal expectancy is around 2.2. So, you know, I think Jota is definitely towards the top end of that market if you wanted to have a goal-scoring interest at a decent price.
He's already been mentioned. Sky Sports' Lewis Jones with us once again. Lewis, we deal with a lot of data on this show. We talk about trends and XG, but you often hear things ahead of a derby like this, like form goes out the window. Is that true or is it nonsense? And if it is true to an extent, how on earth do guys like you quantify that when you're approaching a derby like this?
Yeah, it's a cliche, isn't it? But I do think it does have some basis to it. Even Jurgen Klopp sort of referenced that yesterday in his post-match after the Fulham game, saying this Everton game is always a different animal and it can't really be treated like a normal Premier League game against a team that would be sort of towards the bottom end of the Premier League. And yeah, my neck actually hurts nodding along to Mark there because I'm totally and utterly in agreement with what he's saying about every angle, really. Totally on the pro-Everton side and that Liverpool price probably looking a little bit short to me just of their record at Goodison Park. So, yeah, just in a season where Premier League goals remain quite a staggering rate, really. Everton are just still swimming against that tide, aren't they? And that just comes from their sort of relatively stout defence, which actually looked quite solid against Forest at the weekend after maybe the last six games where it started to drop a little bit. But maybe that's more to do with the Forest attacks more than their defensive sort of unity. And obviously they're misfiring strikers as well. So that sort of adds to why they're the lowest. They've got the lowest total match goal average in the league this season. At just their home games have just averaged 2.25 goals per game. And Fulham are the next in that particular table at 2.88. So it's a big outlier of Everton's average goals at home this season. And no team has been involved in more under 2.5 goal games this season than Everton, with 18 of their 33 going against the grain, sort of delivering two or fewer goals. And actually, surprisingly, Liverpool's away games this season are only averaging 3.06 goals themselves, which is the 12th highest in the league. So I would assume it would have been a little bit higher than that. So maybe probably more to do with their sort of solid defence keeping the goal count down. But I would have thought they would have ranked a little higher than that for the average goals. So and Liverpool are obviously a goal-heavy side, aren't they? But I do want to find a way to back the underline here, I think, with just Everton involved. It's always a tactic I'm looking to utilise, really, when Everton plays. They just tend to drag the goal line down, whoever they play. It happened against Newcastle, who are averaging absolutely monstrous numbers when they rocked up against Everton and the game finished 1-1 and landed for under 2.5 backers and if people that are taking these sort of the Asian lines as well on the goal line. So, some people might point to potential more confident Everton in the attacking third after their 2-0 win over Forest at the weekend. But both those goals were very sort of low quality chances and had to rely on sort of pinpoint finishes from distance from McNeil. And the Idrissa Gueye one was just balmy, wasn't it? I mean, to try that shot another 100 times, I think, and he wouldn't score. So to get for Everton to get that first goal in that game in that environment, I'd say was well timed and sort of maybe drowned in fortune a little bit as well. I think the goalkeeper could have done a little bit better. And the sort of overall expected goals figure from that game pointed to sort of another lack of imagination and spark in the final third. And it's that. Only created, was it 0.34, I think they created. And it's the only time this season when a team have created less than 0.35 worth of expected goals and managed to score twice in a game. So it's they did defy the metrics to land that victory. And yeah, maybe my wallet's talking here. It's a very painful watch, actually, because I was on Forest drawn, I bet, quite heavily, and a lot of other Forest angles, including the Gibbs White goal scorer angle, and obviously those three penalties.
He was in a great position, wasn't he, Gibbs White, at one stage, and put his shot wide.
Yeah, don't need reminding. Thanks for that, Kev. Yeah, and also, the three penalty shouts as well. He's their designated penalty taker, obviously, as well. So that would have been on the cards as well. I thought Forest after the game, obviously, they looked to blame the VAR, didn't they, Stuart Atwell, for all those calls based on. Just based on like the integrity calls that they thought it was going against them. But no, there's just absolute extraordinary and laughable that statement. I know why the calls didn't go their way. It's because whenever I back Gibbs White to score, who is always overpriced as the penalty taker, they somehow failed to be awarded one. So they don't need to direct
the wrong target.
Exactly.
The swing of the VAR should have come hunting you.
Yeah, Jones knows was to blame, unfortunately. That's so it. There he goes. Because I backed him at the game at Newcastle as well to score a penalty, Gibbs White, and when Awoniyi was seemingly tripped when he was scampering to on goal, and that went against him there. So, and then I was on it yesterday as well. So, yeah, no need to suggest corruption. It's all my fault, Nottingham Forest. Just back to the game, and I'm just convinced Everton are going to drag this game down a really ugly, ugly avenue, I think. And I that's the best way to do it. I think, rightly so. It's worked well for him in previous meetings at Goodison Park, and as Mark's referenced there, it's a very low scoring fixture, this. Seven of the last nine Merseyside derbies have gone under 2.5 goals, including the meeting at Anfield earlier this season, where Everton had to play the majority of the game with 10 men after Ashley Young was sent off. So Liverpool found the way through in the end, but it was a very difficult, fiddly game for them, and I can definitely see a similar sort of match scenario playing out here. And as Mark referenced, 9 of the last 13 Merseyside derbies have ended in a draw at Goodison Park. So the draw's a runner, the unders are a runner, I think. And the under three goal line makes sense, doesn't it, on the Asian line, I think, around even money on the Betfair Exchange, meaning we'll get stakes back if there are three goals, lose if there are four or more, and we get an even money return if there's two or more. But as I sort of tempted you in with... lured you in with my shout here regarding the 0-0. I'm going to be brave and back the 0-0 here at 25-1 on the Betfair Exchange. Four of the last six derbies at Goodison have ended 0-0, and I'm just certain Sean Dyche will be playing with that result in mind, I think. And I think the fans will be okay with it as well, because it would sort of end Liverpool's title bid, I think, if they got a draw here 0-0. So, and with the fact that they've eased their relegation fears somewhat slightly, there should be a better mood around Goodison Park. So, defensive football will be sort of stomached, I think, by the home fans, and they'll really get behind them. This is sort of a betting strategy, this 0-0 bet that isn't for everyone. So I know it's a tough watching 0-0, isn't it? When you just know one goal is going to kill your bet. But I do like the fact you can trade out on the Betfair Exchange as the match progresses to lock in either a profit or get your stakes back. So I do think that first halves have been unaffected this season by the sort of increased goal output. So if we back the 0-0 at sort of 25-1 on the exchange, we can get around to about 35 or 40 minutes, maybe to half time, with no goals being scored. We should be able to trade out to at least get our stake back, but still then have the 0-0 correct score running for us at that sort of juicy price. So then if you're watching the second half and it's still 0-0 and there's a goal, it's sort of nothing lost, nothing gained, really. So I do think it's definitely a betting strategy I've utilised over the years when you're backing the 0-0 in a game which you think is going to go under, and then you trade out during the 90 minutes to get your stake back or lock in a bit of profit, and hopefully maybe the 0-0 could come in at the end of the rainbow. So, yeah, I'm all aboard the 0-0 here. Big price, Kev.
Wonderful stuff. Injury time goals, we know. Well, he doesn't want any injury time goals, but it wouldn't matter if you listen to this. Injury time goals can be a pain in the pocket, of course, if they ruin your bet. Now you've got 90-minute payout to rescue you. If the clock hits 90 minutes, you've got the right result. As it stands, your bet wins when the match ticks into injury time. T's and C's in the description. 18 plus. BeGambleAware.org. Now, before the Merseyside derby, we've got a big game in the title race on Tuesday. Arsenal taking on Chelsea. And Lewis, this is a weird one for me, actually, because I've seen Chelsea improve a bit recently. They probably should have got a better result against City in the FA Cup semi-final if they'd taken their chances. They were excellent against Everton the other night, came back from a goal down to beat Manchester United late on at Stamford Bridge. They could cause Arsenal one or two problems if they can be a bit more clinical.
That's right. If the Chelsea show up, if the Chelsea at Wembley show up at the Emirates here on Tuesday, then I think Arsenal are in for actually a big test. And I'd be seriously considering getting involved with laying the home win at 1.56 on the exchange. It's just that I just don't think I can trust this erratic Chelsea team to go back to back in terms of like performance levels. It's very, you know, sort of really well organised and tactically spot on, weren't they? And very good on the counter attack against Man City. But they just didn't put the game to bed when they had the chances. And obviously Nicholas Jackson was to blame for those. But it has made me actually listen to that. I love when he misses a chance because I always just think of Outcast's song, Sorry Miss Jackson. So that's been in my head for the last sort of couple of days.
Well, you've heard that a lot this season.
Exactly. And it should be played on the PA system at grounds when he misses a chance, I think. So everyone would enjoy that, I think. So, yeah, no, Sorry Miss Jackson. It's in the story of his season, really, isn't it? So, I think Chelsea did put an impressive showing together, didn't they, in the final. But I think we do have to treat that performance and the form of that game with a sort of a level of caution, I think, because City are always flat in that FA Cup semi-final. I think I referenced that on the pod and I was very keen to side with Chelsea because they'd only won two of their last six under Guardiola in that fiddly spot for them where it comes between a big Champions League match and obviously the running in the Premier League. And Guardiola was very vocal after, wasn't he, praising his players for sort of getting through that challenge. So he sort of knew that performance was coming. I think that it was very sort of below par and lacking intensity, but they still got through and got the job done, which was a good sign for them. But yeah, it was a missed opportunity for Chelsea, I think. And it wasn't really good football that won City the game in the end, was it? It was their sort of physicality and sort of sheer power.
They hung in there, didn't they?
Yeah. Hung in there, and then they got they struck at the right time with just a very sort of unlike City goal where De Bruyne across, like bounced around in the area, and Silva was quite ruthless with his finish. So,
and their designated handball player Jack Grealish made a brilliant save as well from the free kick. So that helped.
Always good when that goes your way as well. And how the Ashley Young penalty? I'm absolutely scarred by this Forest game.
It's getting flashbacks.
Ashley Young, that was a penalty, wasn't it, surely, in your opinion? The Ashley Young one?
Third one, Stonewall. Third one of the three, Stonewall. The handball, okay, it is what it is. I can see them give and see them not. First one, I'm not convinced. But the third one, I don't know how you can look at that and not give the penalty. But it doesn't mean, folks, that the referees are corrupt. Just means they made a mistake.
Well, I just think it means I always feel like whenever Anthony Taylor and Michael Oliver are in charge, the VAR is quite reluctant to get involved to overturn their decision. I'm not sure if it's because they're the big two in the hierarchy. Maybe there's something in that. That'd be more the reason why I think they weren't keen to get involved to overturn a decision. It was more of a hierarchy thing. But yeah, we must move on from those that Forest game. I've got to put it to bed. I do think Chelsea, if they turn up like they did at Wembley, as I said, I think they'll have a chance. But I just think they're going to meet a very sort of powerful Arsenal team here. Well, they're one of the most streetwise teams in Europe, Arsenal, aren't they? And I just think they're just going to have big moments in the game. Their defence will hold out and they'll probably strike when on top. So that's why I'm going to leave the match prices alone. So I do think Arsenal will eventually win the game, but because just don't really trust Chelsea to turn up. So I'm heading elsewhere for a bet. And I'm sure Mark could vouch for this as well. Lots of sort of my research and digging into prices now is based around sort of matchups, whether that would be sort of a player or a team matched up against a particular weakness in an opposition. And it's been more recently, it's sort of centered around man for man battles, sort of like fullbacks against wingers, etc. So in terms of like foul counts and fouls won, and they're becoming sort of a really popular betting medium now, aren't they, when it comes to the props markets. And there is value to be had, I think, in those markets which are priced up what I'd call a little lazily by the bookmakers now and again, who rely on sort of algorithms to get their prices. And I do like the battle here between Saka and Cucurella down the Arsenal right, and I think we can grab a bit of value on the Cucurella foul line. So, yeah, Saka's Arsenal's sort of go-to guy with the boys, and he sees lots of it down that right-hand side where he links with Odegaard, and he draws lots and lots of fouls. And I think it's actually a tactic from Arsenal to win those fouls with Saka. He's at, didn't say goes down too easy, but he definitely actively looks for fouls, a bit like Grealish does, so they can then bring the big boys up from the set pieces, because that is one of their strengths. So I do think he goes looking for fouls, and he's drawn 22 fouls in his last seven starts. And those that have been tasked with marking him are racking them up here. So we've got Totti for Wolves committed three, Digne for Aston Villa committed two. Against Bayern Munich, Kim came on for the last 15 minutes and committed two fouls against him for Bayern. Alphonso Davies made two against him in the first leg, and Estupiñán made two against Saka against Brighton as well. So that just gives you a sort of flavour of the likelihood of the opposition left-back sort of racking up a pretty hefty foul count when trying to deal with Saka. And his raw average this season is being fouled 2.15 times a game. So he's the 15th most fouled player in that regard for players that have played over 1,000 minutes. So it's quite, again, he's towards the top end of that metric. And if you I switch my mind back to the 2-2 draw, actually, between the teams at Stamford Bridge earlier this season. And Cucurella, I just remember Cucurella being very aggressive on Saka that day, and he committed two fouls and got booked. And that sort of continued a theme of when the pair have met before as well. So in three matches where Cucurella's faced, his last three matches where Cucurella's faced Saka, he's made eight fouls against him. Made three fouls in the Chelsea's 1-0 defeat at the Emirates, and then he made three when playing for Brighton in Brighton's 2-1 win at the Emirates. So he does try and fight fire with fire, Cucurella. He's not that, doesn't strike me as a very intelligent defender. He just seems to be quite rash and looks to get tight and get to the ball ahead of the winger. So I think he's going to give it to Saka early on here. And as he's a very, very, very rash player, very rash fullback. So I want to back his foul prices here. And I make them a bet here at the prices. So he's 6-4 for two or more fouls, and 5-1 to make three or more. He's also been booked actually in seven of his last 14 Premier League starts this season. So that's a 50% strike rate. And he was carded in the reverse fixture for a foul on Saka. So there's a lot of history between these two, and Cucurella is just going to try and play in his usual way. Card prices is a bit meh for me, sort of 21-10 for Cucurella to get booked. But if you add Cucurella to make two fouls in the game and get booked using the bet builder, I do think that becomes a bit more palatable price at 4-1. So yeah, I would be hunting around them Cucurella fouls lines against Saka and seeing if we can maybe combine him to get booked with the foul line as well.
So Cucurella on the naughty step, hopefully. Mark, what have you got for us?
I think this is a fascinating game because I think psychologically the result at the weekend for Arsenal was enormous, really. They dominated that match at Wolves, as you'd expect them to do so, considering Wolves are missing so many sort of frontline players. But to come hot on the heels of that Bayern Munich and Aston Villa disappointment, I think just getting the result was all that was required, really. But I kind of looked at the game a couple of times, really, against Wolves. And yes, they restricted Wolves to very little. But despite the dominance of the ball and the territory Arsenal had, there was quite a lot of similarities, I thought, between their performance against Bayern Munich as well, because they had 24 shots against Wolves, but the XG came in under 1.2. So the average XG per shot is under 0.05. That does need addressing for Arsenal. I know Wolves defended with a low block and it makes life quite difficult to fashion those opportunities, but that's probably an area of weakness in recent weeks, really. They're not conjuring up really sort of high quality opportunities, which perhaps they were at the turn of the year. But it's an enormous 5 days for Arsenal, meeting sort of two of their rivals in quick succession, both of which will want to scupper those title challenges. And yeah, Chelsea obviously will be smarting, no silverware this season, but they're still very much in the hunt for European qualification. So there's a couple of reasons why Chelsea will be gunning for Arsenal here. And I thought they performed really well against City at the weekend. And, they'll be ruining that defeat, obviously, because of the chances missed. But it's just another harsh lesson for a young side, I think. If you don't take your opportunities against good teams, you'll get beaten and punished. But I think there's a lot of positives to take. And look, sure, City were laboured after the Champions League, but I think Chelsea have proven a few times now, in fairness to them, that they can step up in class in the big matches that matter. I'm almost more willing to trust them in these games against elite opponents than when they're facing bottom half dross. You know, we've seen sort of complacency and arrogance creep in against the likes of Burnley and Sheffield United as an example. But go back to the reverse game against Arsenal at the Bridge. They were very good, very organised, very effective. Both home and away against Man City, they put in some really good shifts in the Premier League as well at Wembley at the weekend. So that's three games against City, once against Arsenal. It's only really Liverpool away where they waved that white flag and were kind of incinerated without really showing up. So they've only lost four games since Boxing Day, which did surprise me, two of which have been in the Premier League. It's been a League Cup final and an FA Cup semi-final. So I would be willing to sort of back them with a vote of confidence here with a plus 1.25 star on the Asian handicap, knowing Arsenal need to win by two clear goals for the bet not to make money. But for similar reasons to Lewis and just a little bit of doubt after the weekend, quick turnaround, I'm going to go elsewhere. I've got a player prop and also a cards-based bet. So I know you guys have spoken about Cole Palmer at length, especially after that performance against Everton last Monday, but there are some fancy prices around for him this midweek. And I appreciate it's all, you know, quite attractive based on Arsenal's shots against figures, which we know their defensive data is exceptional this season. But this is must-win for Arsenal. They're under pressure. They're going to have to play front-foot football. And I think that does give Chelsea opportunities here as quite a lively underdog, especially on the counter-attack, as we saw at the weekend too. So you can get 5-6 on Cole Palmer to have two shots or more and at least one shot on target, which looks nice as a base, as a sort of foundation. You can also get 11-4 on Cole Palmer to have at least two shots on target, which I think is worth a wee poke here, actually. He's had at least two shots on target in seven of his last nine starts, including at the weekend at Wembley. He had four shots on target in the EFL Cup final against Liverpool, and he's had multiple shots in 29 of 35 starts for Chelsea, and he's had multiple shots on target in 15 of those fixtures too. So the 11-4 looks a little bit big to me there for a bit of interest. And also, I don't think we can ignore over 4.5 cards here at 5-6 with Simon Hooper refereeing six in the reverse match, seven in one of their meetings last season. Chelsea's matches have featured plenty of cautions all season, really. A huge game for Arsenal, big game for Chelsea too. Fancy it to get a little bit spicy.
I think you've been doing too much Scott watch, Mark. Worth a wee poke. I didn't expect that. Lovely stuff. Like something out of a Rabbi Burns poem. Lovely stuff. Brighton against Manchester City. Now, your initial instinct is to think, oh, that might be difficult up against a De Zerbi team. But actually, Mark, are Brighton a bit cooked here? Are they kind of just sliding towards a bit of a meh ending to the season?
Yeah, I think so. I brought Brighton's kind of disappointing goal output on the show up a few weeks back, and I know it's been mentioned since then a couple of times as well. I'm not sure who else did point it out, but it's definitely been mentioned a few times. It's no real secret anymore that Brighton have regressed. That's understandable, really. You sell very influential players last summer. You've got a crippling injury crisis, lost your key attacking personnel to injury for the season, plus the added fatigue from playing a first ever kind of European campaign. It's kind of all caught up in them. And then you've got De Zerbi, who doesn't really know what he wants in terms of his managerial career from here. Lots of sort of wranglings about his future. I'm not saying they're on the beach at all. I don't really like that tag. I don't think he would allow his team to sort of suit that style. But there are questions to be answered with Brighton right now. So across their last 17 Premier League matches, they've only scored 20 goals. Wow. But in 14 of those 17 games, they've either failed to score or scored a maximum of one goal. And that's because they've scored 13 goals across three games against Spurs, Palace and Sheffield United during that sample. So, you know, exclude those three games where they went a bit goal mental. They've been really struggling in the final third, and it's just four goals in the last seven games. And their underlying metrics have really unravelled as well. Quite shockingly so, actually. If you look at the last 16 Premier League matches for all teams in the top flight, Brighton are posting a non-penalty XG output of 1.2. Now, to put that into context, the worst MPXG output in that same 16-game sample is Crystal Palace with 1.13. Brighton are at 1.20. So Everton, Forest, Wolves, Burnley, Luton are all posting a better attacking output over the last 16 games. Even Manchester United are posting a better output than Brighton
even
right
them.
Now.
Even those bozos, even they're doing it. But who are we missing here, Mark? So we don't have Mitoma. We haven't had Solly March for ages. Who are we missing? Who are the big players?
Well, João Pedro's been in and out quite frequently. He's not been a consistent starter. And Evan Ferguson has really got off the boil from that purple patch really too. But I think they're the key ones in forward areas, but I don't think we can get away from the sale of McAllister and Caicedo either.
They were enormous. Basically, isn't it really?
Yeah, absolutely enormous figures. And then, you lose your sort of two key wide men as well. It's difficult for a club like Brighton. And I don't want to criticise them because, you know, they're sat comfortably mid-table. They've had a very decent campaign. It's not like they're underperforming. We just got such high expectations of that club right now, but kind of compared their league position to their budget, and they're still probably overperforming this season. So, on this occasion, I think we have to oppose them. And, you know, it's quite concerning, I think, to be sort of returning those kind of figures ahead of a game against Man City. We saw Arsenal come here and kind of school them quite comprehensively not so long ago. So for me, it's just a trip to an old favourite here, which is to back Man City to win and under 4.5 goals at 10 to 11. I don't quite have the minerals to back City to win to nil or the BTTS no, just considering City's clean sheet returns recently. But I think this selection allows you to have a home goal or the nil on your side with the 1-0, 2-0, 3-0, 4-0, 2-1 or 3-1. That's a range of, you know, the most likely correct scores. You're getting, 191? So not a million miles off evens here. So I don't think City will run riot. I still think they'll win the game relatively comfortably. But they've got, obviously had a quite taxing couple of weeks, and they've got a trip to Forest on the Sunday. This is a Thursday night game. So it's a quick turnaround again for them. So expect changes.
Yeah, Lewis, this is an interesting one from Manchester City's point of view, because we talk about schedules, and Pep Guardiola was very open about the fact he thought it was outrageous that they played on a Saturday in the FA Cup semi-final after that game against Real Madrid. But apart from Rodri, you get the sense they've got a like-for-like replacement for everybody, right? Even the goalkeeper. I mean, I think Stefan Ortega's a really good backup for Ederson. So it's a pretty strong squad, isn't it, really?
It is, and I think one of the key aspects of this season has been keeping your players fit, hasn't it? I mean, we've seen so many injuries across the board, and it seems as though Pep and Mikel Arteta have maybe reined it in for half the season in terms of just intensity and just knowing they can get through games playing a very controlled style of football, which doesn't lead to injuries. And I actually think this is one of the reasons why Erling Haaland doesn't get involved in much of their approach play. So I think they're worried about his injury record. So if he was tasked with getting involved and running channels and moving away from sort of dangerous areas of the pitch, his injury record would come into play there, I think, because he is likely to put strain on his body, because he's suffered a lot of injuries in his young career already. So I do think that's why they play to Haaland like that, maybe just to preserve him for the season. I know I'm not sure what the injury situation with him ahead of the Thursday game. Maybe hopefully just a bit of tiredness. But I do think that, the way that Guardiola manages his squad in terms of keeping players out from injury is exceptional. And that could be, another decisive factor in the title race. And that probably goes against Liverpool, hasn't it, this season, the amount of injuries they've had. Ahead of this game, it's very strange, I think, because City could be actually 4 points behind both Arsenal and Liverpool by kickoff, but still be sort of 1.65 to win the Premier League, so because of those two games in hand. So it does,
because they're robots and they never slip up at this stage of the season.
Apparently so, yes. It does sort of create a bit of an exciting dynamic, doesn't it? The City are in control of their own destiny, but they're also being the chaser as well. So I do think it adds to the excitement, even though City are obviously very likely to go on and win this game and possibly not slip up for the rest of the season. They're just the team to deal with this scenario, aren't they? They've been there, done that. They showed that on Sunday, even though they weren't at their best. They kept that clean sheet and they got the goal when it mattered. So, as you mentioned in your intro there, this is a different type of fixture than what it could have been for Man City last season at Brighton. I mean, some people might get lured into thinking this is a difficult game for Pep Guardiola's team, but in many ways, the state of Brighton going forward and their style of play is actually the perfect scenario for City, I think. I mean, because how do you cause City problems? You mentioned this before. I'm very, very keen on backing teams against them who have got a good counter-attacking record. And you score goals by them by being really sort of quick in transition and getting the ball forward quickly by counter-attacking. And Real Madrid showed that. Chelsea showed that. Yeah. The likes of Tottenham and Newcastle have utilised that brilliantly this season against City to rack up multiple goals in a game. But Brighton just aren't that team under De Zerbi. They're so possession-based. They like to sort of play through a press and lure the other team onto them and create overloads in wide areas. And that is actually seen through their lack of fast breaks. So another word for a counter-attack. I know we've referenced this stat quite a lot in recent weeks. They've actually put together the fewest of any team in the Premier League this season. So just 8 fast breaks all season. That's 5 fewer than any other team. So they're just not a counter-attacking team. Once they get the ball, they just want to control. Happy to go back to the centre-backs. And that's where they start their attacks. Lewis Duncan, Van Hecker are very good at drawing the press out and playing through it. And that's how they want to play. But I think City can cope with that pretty easily, to be honest. Brighton are probably going to have a bit of the ball, but the way that they've put structure in their attacks recently and the lack of chance creation is really going to make it tough for them to get through City once they're back in their shape and organised. So, I'll be very surprised, actually, if Brighton score in this match. We have been profiting quite well from Brighton's lack of goals, actually, which the market hasn't really caught up with. The betting strategy has to be surrounding the goals in the game. And again, I'm happy to play the under 3 goal line here. And this is a bet that you wouldn't have lost any money on in Brighton's last 8 games. So they've would have made a profit on 5 of those occasions. So that's obviously back in the under 3 goal line in the exchange where we can get 2.3 when the market. I'd anticipate about 2.3 being available on the market when it's fully sort of fully liquid. So, which means we only lose our stake if there are 4 or more goals. 3 goals would be a push, and we would win if there are 2 or fewer goals in the game at 2.3, which I think is a very interesting runner indeed. And it's a bet which landed for us with the Arsenal-Wolves game at the weekend at 1.9, where there were just 2 goals. And I do like playing this bet at the moment, where the market is still sort of skewed towards the total goals average this season being very high. So I do think it's a great insurance policy when you fancy the underline, especially when you've got the Asian line on your side. Because us unders bettors are about to go into hibernation a bit this season. So it's good to be able to finally come out at the end of the season where perhaps teams like Man City, like Arsenal, and to a certain extent Liverpool are just getting the job done and racking up sort of low wins, low score lines. So, defensively, Brighton have been okay, actually, the last few weeks as well. And over the season, the expected metrics are all right. They've only conceded 1.43 expected goals against at home, and that's the fifth best defensive record in the league. And they've only conceded 19 goals in those 15 home games. And again, that's the fifth best record in the league. So I expect City to find a way through, but I do think Brighton can be trusted to put up a bit of a resistance with Duncan Van Hecke. In quite good form recently. I think they played really well at Liverpool, actually, when they restricted Liverpool to quite a difficult afternoon where Liverpool finally got through and won 2-1, wasn't it? So, and I'm not really sure City are in the right sort of current mood or state to thrash a team at the moment due to their schedule. So their last 2 games have fallen under the 2.5 goal line. And I think that might be a trend that's going to continue over the next few weeks about opposing goals in City's game. So last season in the running, when playing away from home, so this is from the Champions League quarterfinal onwards, all 8 of their matches saw less than 4 goals last season. So if you'd backed the under 3.0 Asian line in all of those matches, you'd have made a good level stakes profit. And I'm sort of planning on doing the same, putting that theory into play over the run in here. So we're going to back the under 3 line here. And I just think they're just going to be in the mood to get the job done and get out, I think. So Mark said he wasn't brave enough to back City to win to nil. I'm probably a little bit more braver or reckless with my punting, so to speak. Not as measured as O'Hare. So I'm happy to chase a price where one's available. And I do quite like splitting my stakes on City to win 1-0 or 2-0 on the exchange. They're both sort of around the 11-1 mark. So if you sort of Dutch your stakes or splitting your stakes, that method works out backing like a 4-1 shot for City to win 1-0 or 2-0. And I thought that was a little big. So yeah, I do think City will come through this test pretty easy, and it's going to be hard for Brighton to get on the score sheet, I think.
Yep. Killjoys are fighting back, finding ways to back under goals. Lovely stuff. If you want to be notified, by the way, every time a new episode of Football Only Better goes live, make sure you follow wherever you get your podcasts. And for the YouTube version, make sure you like and subscribe Betfair's new channel for non-racing content. Mark, Oliver Glasner's Palace, absolutely flying. Jean-Philippe Mateta's been put into some kind of cryogenic tube. They've messed around with him and they found this incredible striker who's banging in goals left, right and centre. Where did this come from?
It's taken a while, hasn't it? but I guess Glasner has known about Mateta's qualities from his previous career across Europe. But Palace are all but mathematically safe from relegation. 11 points clear of the drop with Luton having just four games to play. So they're pretty much secured their status for next season after sort of walloping West Ham at the weekend. And I can kind of understand where the market is here to a point, because Newcastle are in decent form, aiming to secure European qualification. So you can understand why the market might think you've got a low motivated club here hosting a high motivated club, and that will impact the prices. Of course it will. But just looking at how Palace played at the weekend and then listening to Glasner talk in terms of his analysis of that performance and his demands really from here till the end of the campaign. And this fixture, especially the fact it's taking place at Selhurst Park, for me, kind of negates those motivational concerns. Sunday was the first time this season that Palace have won back-to-back Premier League games. They're now very eager to make it three. And I think we're starting to see the side or the start of something, I wouldn't say special, but promising at least at Selhurst Park, because the style of football will undoubtedly improve under Glasner. I still don't think we've seen the best of Palace or Glasner's Palace yet, but there are promising signs already.
You've got to keep Bertier and Elise on the pitch, right? If you can actually keep them fit somehow, then that's the key to the whole thing, isn't it?
Well, they only started together for the sixth time this season in the Premier League on Sunday, which is incredible, really.
That's
They've
bonkers.
Both had major injury problems, and you saw the impact they had. They were unplayable, the pair of them. They scored two goals and had two assists between them. 11 shots in total, more than Palace as a whole team had managed in 15 league fixtures this season, which is astonishing, really. So when they're fit, when they're available, when they play together, Palace are a serious threat. And then, you know, we sort of scoff at him, but Mateta has improved immeasurably in the last couple of weeks in terms of his output and his all-round game too. And I don't think that's a huge surprise when you've got the likes of Eze and Elise playing off him too. So I think going forward, Palace are potentially quite exciting in the future if they can keep hold of those players. But also Adam Wharton, he's really sort of stepped up since his move from Blackburn. I thought he was immense, really, away at Liverpool. Joachim Andersen, we know he can be a mountain of a centre-half. So the foundations are pretty much there for Palace. They just need a bit of a sprinkling around the edges, really, to sort of bring them up into perhaps a sort of lock for mid-table next season. But they did get a little bit lucky on Sunday playing an opponent who looked pretty tired and beaten, really, after the European elimination. Once that first goal went in, you know, West Ham pretty much just waved the white flag and Palace enjoyed themselves. But I was impressed with how they went for the jugular, really, and showed little mercy. And I think, you know, they will be eager to end the season on a high. I think Glasner's latest game plan out pretty clear at the weekend in terms of just continuing where they are. And I think they're dangerous opponents here for Newcastle, who, look, I think Palace basically are very interesting underdogs. We can get them on side with a quarter goal start here at 182, which means they make money if they avoid defeat. And for all the praise I've given Eddie Howe in terms of getting Newcastle back into a top six position, despite all the injuries, you know, they're still missing tons of players. Basically, a full first 11 are out missing. Excuse me. This Newcastle team still have only won four away games all season. In their last away game, they did win at Fulham, but it was a very sneaky win. Yeah. They were dominated for the most part. Balance of play, they didn't deserve it. So in 11 of 15 away days, this bet has made money opposing Newcastle. And they've also shipped multiple goals in 10 of those 15 away days. So I think whenever Eze and Elise are fit, available and informed together, Palace are going to be dangerous, especially at Selhurst Park. So happy to have them with the start. No shot prices at the minute, but I'd be looking at combinations of Eze and Elise there together too. If you did fancy a goal for either player, it's 23-10 Eze, 10-3 Elise. So I think both prices are quite appealing, but I'll keep it simple with Palace with a quarter goal start.
And finally, Manchester United up against Sheffield United. The Red Devils
pretty solid against Coventry for an hour of their FA Cup semi-final and then absolutely ruined the bed. I won't go any further than that. But what an utterly appalling performance, Lewis, in the final 20 minutes of normal time and in extra time. I mean, the hanging on against the Championship team, as good as Coventry are, I was pretty pathetic, wasn't it, really?
Yeah, an abomination, maybe, I'd say.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say.
I love that. That word rarely comes out, but I think it's fair to use in this situation. Just play weird, aren't they, Manchester United? I mean, yeah. They sort of find ways to completely baffle me. I love this job, and I love like trying to analyse teams and trying to find angles and trying to gauge where teams are and how they play, etc. But this team, it's just absolutely amazing how they can be so comfortable at 3-0 up in a game and then all of a sudden just forget how to play football, really. Yeah, collapse. It was a collapse. And it was credit Coventry for almost taking full advantage. And that offside line, I mean, yeah, that's going to live long in the memory of Coventry fans, that offside decision, isn't it? But I'd say it was more of the same for Manchester United. They sort of did it in different ways this time by playing quite well for 60 minutes and dominating and deservedly being 3-0 up and then just throwing it all the way to nearly being knocked out of the competition. So, very strange. I just want to have a mention for Antony as well. I think he should get a 3-game ban. I'm not sure if you saw the photo of him cupping his ear towards the Coventry players as he ran.
What an imbecile!
As he ran towards his teammates. Yeah, that didn't really sit well with me. And I'm sort of pretty good at staying emotionless when having to analyse teams, just in order to come to sort of sensible betting decisions. But I mean, this Man United team are becoming very unlikable, I'd say, at the moment.
To be fair, on the flip side of that, apparently Harry Maguire and Bruno Fernandes were lovely with the Coventry players afterwards and kind of a bit embarrassed by the whole thing or what have you. But if you've got Antony kind of, you know, acting as if he's just scored the winner against Real Madrid in the Champions League final, it's like, mate, what are you doing? What's going on?
Let's not let the facts get in the way of me getting angry, Kev. Come on. It's three game ban all day. But yeah, I didn't like to see that from him. And it was a fair play to Maguire and Fernandes for doing that. But yeah, it's just a mess. It's just a mess. And there's so many angles coming into this game. I'm really excited about this game, actually. I know not many people will, Manchester United versus Sheffield United, but I think there's loads of pro Sheffield United goals angles here to take full advantage of in the market. Because I can see this Manchester United team being completely unprepared and disrespect for this game. I think you've got Sheffield United at home. The expectation levels are going to be high at Old Trafford from the crowd. The players, are they going to be a little bit mentally and physically fatigued from Wembley? And can you really see the likes of Casemiro, Bruno Fernandes really pumping themselves up and being at their best for the visit of Sheffield United at home on a Wednesday night? I think players of that ilk will be thinking they can just probably turn up at 60% and win this game. But that doesn't happen in football, especially at the top level. And I think Sheffield United are actually there to take advantage of United's likely poor focus. Obviously, they're down and out probably certainly in their survival for Premier League status. But I'm just hoping that sort of playing at Old Trafford might just keep enough of them interested to put on a performance, because it might be could be the last time that a few of these lads get to play at Old Trafford in their careers. So, and there's certainly been more threat from Sheffield United in the attacking third since Chris Wilder came in. And they were very unlucky, actually, not to score more than one goal against Burnley in a defeat on Saturday. I know that result looks horrendous from a result perspective, but I was covering the game. I was actually really impressed with Sheffield United's attacking play. They created lots of chances and really should have been 2-0 up before Burnley hitting with the quick fire double just before the break. And McAtee and Gustavo Hama and then Big Ben and Burnie performed really well again. I think they're really sort of, it's quite a dynamic and powerful foursome to go to play at this level with. And yeah, in that game, they won the XG battle in that 4-1 defeat. They created 2.43 expected goals to Burnley's 2.18. They won 11 corners. They had 14 shots from inside the box and they had 60 touches in Burnley's box. And I think the main difference really was the goalkeepers. I mean, the Burnley goalkeeper, Muric, he actually was made of things you associate with humans, you know, bones, muscle, tendons, and he did his job brilliantly. But then the Sheffield United goalkeeper, Gribic, is seemingly made of poppadoms, I think. So
he's had a nightmare. You think of that goal he gave away at Anfield, which was just the doziest thing I've ever seen. And he was terrible, really.
He was awful against Burnley as well. I wouldn't mind dipping him in some mango chutney, but I don't think he's a goalkeeper I want to trust. And just, yeah, everything just seemed to go through him versus Burnley. And he was really awful. I've not watched much of him, but I have heard people were sort of praising the signing, actually, when he first came over. But I don't know much about him, but on what I've seen, he just looks like he's incapable of saving a shot. So I've got no
faith. I don't think Old Black was particularly worried at Atletico, put it that way.
Yes, well put. So I've got no faith in Sheffield United in the outright market here. So they just can't be trusted to keep this sort of Manchester United moments team quiet. They'll have their moments in the game and they'll probably score 2-3 goals. But I think Chris Wilder's team can definitely add to what should be quite a goal-heavy game. So they've scored at least once in five of their last six games, and they've scored 9 goals in total in those games. And I just think with nothing to lose, I'm certain Wilder's just going to go to Old Trafford and just play with the handbrake off, I think, and play McAtee, play Hamer, play the two big boys up front and just try and just cause some chaos, I think, and have a turn it into a bit of a shootout. And I don't think this Man United defence can be trusted to keep them out, actually. They've kept just 3 clean sheets in their last 19 Premier League games. And they've got serious issues still across the back line, haven't they? So it could be Maguire and Ambuala again, or maybe Casemiro might drop in there if he can make it off his. Well, he'd probably be in bed for the last day, hasn't he? He looked like he was absolutely shattered after that performance.
Recovering
yet after that penalty as well. I wouldn't get out of bed for days if I took that penalty. So I can see Sheffield United adding to the scoreline here. So. Yeah, United have conceded, and I really, really like this bet. This is my best bet of the midweek card. So United have conceded 2 or more goals in 7 of their last 10 matches across all competitions, while Sheffield United have scored twice or more in 9 of their last 17 games of all competitions. So when trying to work out a probability for how many goals Sheffield United should be scoring in this match, sort of based on those numbers, I had it around a 50% chance of them scoring twice. Yet the prices that have been offered up here on the sports book, we can get 11-4 for Sheffield United to score over 1.5 goals, which the implied probability of that is 26%. So that's a huge edge on where the true price should be in my view. And I think that 11-4 for Sheffield United to score at least twice is actually really worth backing at 11-4. And I'd even go further than that. And I wouldn't put people off having a stab at the anytime goal scorer prices for Sheffield United here either, with Big Ben and Burnley are both 7-2 to score. Got Hamer, who's very good in front of goal. He scored twice, I think, in his last 9 games. He scored a very nice goal against Burnley. He's 5-1 anytime. McAtee's 11-2 anytime. And I think they're all worth a second look. And so I'm going to get a little bit clever here. And as I fancy the Blades to score twice, I think I'm going to use the bet builder to combine those goal scorer prices too, to see if two of them can score in the match. So if you want to do the Big Ben and Burnley goal scorer double, you can get 14-1. Palmer and Brereton Diaz to score is 18-1. So these are sort of examples of the prices. If you can, if you don't want to take the 11-4 and you're looking to cheer on like a big price, backing two of those guys to score in various multiples looks the way to go, I think. And I also want to play, there's another bet. I've got so many Sheffield United bets here in this game. I also want to play the theory of Man United underestimating Sheffield United in the first half and putting in a lacklustre showing. I think that's a massive runner here, just of what's gone on before. And they've made a habit of slow starts this season at Old Trafford in their goal outputs. So they've only scored 7 first half goals in 15 league games at Old Trafford this season, failing to score in 10 of those matches. And if you exclude penalties, they've only scored 5 first half goals in 15 home Premier League games, and no team has scored fewer non-penalty first half goals in the Premier League. So I just think with Sheffield United likely to play with a handbrake off and no fear, and having a really impressive attacking process at the moment, I feel like prices for them to score the first goal at 11-4 are also a little bit too big, as is the 7-1 for them to be winning the match at 20 minutes. I think they could easily get the first goal in this game and be leading after 20 minutes. All these prices are just jumping off the page to me. It looks like a really cracking betting heat to take advantage of some Sheffield United attacking numbers. So, but the big one that stands out has to be Sheffield United to score over 1.5 goals at 11-4.
That's all we have time for on this midweek edition of Football Only Better. Please do remember to gamble responsibly. Remember, we've got lots of weekend previews coming up, as always, later in the week. Make sure you like and subscribe to our YouTube channel for non-racing content. And of course, we've got loads of written previews from the Premier League and beyond on our website, betting.betfair.com. From Mark, from Lewis, and from me, it's goodbye for now.